This is the rehearsal for the Portland State University Alumni Weekend talk in October of 1999. One indelible dusk, I squinted across the land where I was growing up and saw that the prairie had turned into a seascape. The wind was blowing, as it did day and night that summer, and the moving waves of rich yellow wheat could just be seen in the settling dark. A harvesting combine cruised on the far side of the field. I had never been within 1,000 miles of an ocean, but in the sudden shadow play of my mind, I could see that the combine, with its running lights just flicked on, was a ship bound through the night. Bench Hills rose to the north, surely a fair coastline. The expanse of it all, hills and fields and wind in the wheat, ran out far beyond, oceanic, to where the sky and the flat horizon fitted together. The magic of place is indelible. I was 17, a restless farmhand with my nose in a book whenever I wasn't atop a tractor or grain truck, there at that found sea, which was both fictional and real. And now, at 60, I still write about both the rim of the prairie along the Rockies there where I grew up, and the green jigsawed Pacific Northwest coastline where I live now. Before I'm done today, you'll have a brief taste of my new novel, Mountain Time, which has settings in both of these literary homes of mine. But I'm up here at this microphone to try to think out loud to you about some of my own makings as a writer with dual citizenship in those two high, wide, and handsome territories. And I'll be salt and peppering that in with a few other ingredients that I think gives literature its particular flavors. To start, as writers are supposed to start, at some kind of a beginning, let's take on the big one, that eternal audience question, where do you get your ideas? Always a good question, but the answer is always tough. It's not as if writers live in an aquarium, the writer floating dreamily all day long in the fluid of thought and word, and at supper time, the figure of God, in the unlikely disguise of a literary critic, drops in the fish food. No, the writer has to get out and hunt beyond the glass bowl of every day. The 9 bars of a Montana town where my father judiciously bent his elbow as he hired his haying crews, while the boy that was me watched from the generous vicinity of that elbow. The diary of a man who came west with the California gold rush, found out that mining is sweaty work, and turned north to a life of oystering and roistering at Willapa Bay and farther up our northwest coast. An 1853 newspaper article to the effect that, "Dear editor, I thought you might like to know that last Sunday, as some of the settlers were crossing the bay, they found, drifting in a canoe, men nearly starved to death. They have completed a journey of escape from New Archangel, more than 1,000 miles in winter." The imagined voice of a sheepherder saying to a teenage boy, "Don't just stand there in your tracks, kid. We've got all these dead sheep to skin." A valley of homesteaders' cabins, vest pocketed in the Rockies, regularly put upon by tough weather, barreling down out of those glorious mountains. A woman with a camera and an attitude, and a pesty ex-husband working for the same newspaper she does. A packet of World War II letters, lost to sight for some 40 years. A chorus of voices chiming out of years of tape-recorded interviews, finding their common note in Depression-era jobs on the construction of the biggest earthen dam in the world. When we got on at Fort Peck, a high lonesome, a week of solitary backpacking into the wilderness area named for the bat-eared Mozart of the Forest Service who thought up the wilderness system, Bob Marshall. It sounds like the list for a lifelong scavenger hunt, doesn't it? It is. These 9 items, some actual and some imagination-induced, are the first footsteps in the mind toward my now 9 books. Then the clock takes over. 25 years worth of crafting those pieces of idea into fullness of stories, dimensions of characters, and galaxies of language. For me, art comes by way of craft, of working and reworking those sounds that come off the page. The heart of the language must beat there. 3 hearts, really. The rhythms and tides of the bloodstream we all share, words, constitute the first of those hearts. Those of us who write in English have an ocean of language to work with. Its surf drum of music, its patterns of sound, go beyond its wealth of individual words. Let me give you the example I came up against when I had just finished my first book, and the editor and I suddenly realized we were going to have to do a lot better than the manuscript's working title, which was, well, I'm not even going to tell you. You'll have to pry it out of me in the question session if you really want to know. Now, usually I am more a rewriter than a writer, tinkering through a lot of versions to hit the right one. But this one time, in only about an hour of writing, the long devotion of the mind to the fingers put this onto the page for me. In the night, in mid-dream, people who are entire strangers to one another sometimes will congregate atop my pillow. They file into my sleeping skull in perplexing medleys. A face from grade school may be twinned with one met a week ago on a rainforest trail in the Olympic Mountains. A pair of friends I joked with yesterday now drift in arguing with an editor I worked for more than 1,000 miles from here. How thin the brain walls must be, so easily can acquaintanceships be struck up among these random residents of the dark. Memory, the near neighborhood of dream, is almost as casual in its hospitality. When I fix my sandwich lunch in a quiet noon, I may find myself sitting down all those years ago in the company of the erect old cowboy from Texas, Walter Badgett. Forever the same as the meal with Walter, fried mush with dark corn syrup, and bread which Walter first has toasted and then dried in the oven. When we bite, it shatters and crashes in our mouths, and the more we eat, the fuller our plates grow with the shrapnel of crumbs. After the last roaring bite, Walter sits back tall as 2 of the 10-year-old me and asks down, "Well, reckon we can make it through till night now, Ivan?" I step to the stove for tea and come instead onto the battered blue enamel coffee pot in a sheepherder's wagon, my father's voice now saying, "You could float your grandma's flat iron on the Swede's coffee." I walk back toward my typewriter, past a window framing the backyard fir trees. They are replaced by the wind-leaning jack pines of one Montana ridgeline or another. I glance higher for some hint of the weather, and the square of air broadens and broadens to become the blue expanse over Montana rangeland, so vast and vaulting that it rears from the foundation line of the plains horizon to form the walls and roof of all of life's experience that my younger self could imagine. A single great house of sky. As you can hear, there by the last few words of that passage, the rhythms of the language had delivered me the title, This House of Sky. That's the orchestral sweep of language, so to speak. And there's also glorious possibility in its individual notes. The late Richard Hugo, the bigger-than-life poet of Washington and Montana, gave the world one of the canniest books on the craft of using words on paper, The Triggering Town, with alloys of common sense and revelation, such as this paragraph. A student may love the sound of Yeats' line, stumbling upon the blood-dark track once more, and not know that the single-syllable word with a hard consonant ending is a unit of power in English. And that's one reason blood-dark track goes off like rifle shots. The young poet, Hugo continues, is too often paying attention to the big things and can't be bothered with little matters like that. But little matters like that are what make and break poems. Those little matters that are the tools poets work with greatly interest me, because that's the shop I've always liked to hang around in. As a fiction writer, which I mostly am, I don't seem to have come out from under Gogol's overcoat, where Turgenev said all short story writers popped out of. I've never written a short story in about 1 million published words now, and don't show any signs of doing so. Instead, I seem to be from under the cloak of prose's singing teachers, our betters, the poets. The poetic urge caught up with me in an unexpected place while I was working on a PhD in history. What graduate school taught me back there in the late 60s was that I didn't want to be on a university faculty. I found myself freelancing magazine articles during grad school, and I also began, to my surprise, writing poetry, which I had never even thought of attempting before. My 8 or 9 published poems showed me that I lacked the poet's final skill, the one Yeats called closing a poem with the click of a well-made box. But still wanting to stretch the craft of writing toward the areas where it mysteriously starts to be art, I began working on what I later heard Norman MacLean call the poetry under the prose. In my case, a lyrical style with what I call a poetry of the vernacular in how my characters speak on the page. Whether it is the Depression cruise, riding the tension spiders of steelwork at Fort Peck Dam in my novel Bucking the Sun, or the handless bartender Lucas Barclay in Dancing at the Rascal Fair, hoisting his glass to the other America comers of the homestead era, fearlessly toasting in his Scotch burr, broth to the ill, stilts to the lame. I've tried to give my characters that touch of the poet that working people so often have. I'll get back to this a little further into this talk, but let me move now to the geography of the language, the sense of place that critics so often cite in those of us who grew up in the sagebrush and somehow turned out to be writers. This is the second heart of writing, the home heart, the one of that matchless Robert Louis Stevenson stanza, "Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill." One of the ways a writer comes home from his hills where life has taken him is a process I like to call seeing with the ear and hearing with the eye. The eye starts to listen and remember, to register for good how the way a rancher cocks his hat says something about that man. The ear starts to see and remember how ordinary language can be made to glow as if breathing on an ember in a cold morning cook stove. In my own case, when I was still down there in the vicinity of the elbow, a kind of Northern Lights Out Loud began to speak to me. "You're not sugar nor salt nor nobody's honey, so the rain will never hurt you," she crooned to me. That one goes around looking like she's been yanked through a knot hole backwards, she huffed about our worst-dressed neighbor. And she confided about the couple dallying together in our wide-eyed little town. Those two are as close as three in a bed with one kicked out. Into my life had come that river of proverbs, my grandmother. I was 10 years of age, but my ears were as old as sin. All of a sudden, I knew I was in new territory of life, something like honorary adulthood. Now, besides my Scottsburr storytelling widower father, here was my mother's mother in this reluctant knot of bloodline the two of them had made to raise me. You bet my ears were busy from then on with the picture play of words from my grandmother, whose formal education had broken off at the third grade. Whenever the prairie wind would swirl up her dress and she would announce, "Balloon ascension!" Or with the bloodstream music of rhyme when my father, from the heights of his eighth grade education, would ask, "Have they taught ye this one yet?" and begin reciting to my dropped jaw, "Hiawatha." It lasts. We've known so ever since art began to dance off the cave walls to us. Literature perhaps begins there, in the painted bison running in the tunnels of time, and the hunting escapades they represent being told around the fire. I think that's what we're still up to, in the white canyons of paper, and now the nebulae of cyberspace. I think stories and the play of words still can be our way of sharing light, of sitting together around humanity's fire with the universal dark all around us. Our work, our words, of course have to start on the cave walls between our own ears. Let me take you briefly through this writerly process of sitting around in your own head using an example I know best, my own. Among the countless colored coats that a story can wear, this particular time it was dressed old-fashioned, black and white and red all over. That old pun, remember, about newspapers before they became such an endangered species. The accumulated century of the weekly newspaper of Choteau, Montana, grandly named Choteau Acantha, actually is in red protective binders in the public library there in the small town of Choteau. So, this becomes a Thursday. The evening, the Choteau Public Library stays open past supper time, and I am sitting there as I have sat in front of so many dusty troves of research, at a table on the library's little mezzanine, going through old newsprint to hear into that area of Montana during the Depression years, the drought years. In mid-February of 1939, the homespun local columnist reports that there had been a heavy fog, unusual to that climate and time of year. A stirring begins on the library stairs, and up comes a group of women from a Hutterite colony near Choteau. In their long skirts and patterned aprons and kerchiefs, these religious communal dwellers might have just stepped out of the pages of Tolstoy. I keep sitting there and open the next red binder. The columnist is saying in the issue of May 18, 1939, if the adage of rain 90 days after a fog holds good, obviously a Montana adage rather than a Northwest adage, a heavy soaking rain will come on the 21st. Steps on the mezzanine stairs again, a ranch wife appears and begins browsing forcefully through the fiction shelves. No nonsense about it as she flips open novels and takes or rejects them on the basis of their opening sentence. I reopen the red binder to the next week's newspaper, May 25th, 1939, which reports that a downpour started in the early morning of the 22nd. It went on all through the day and into the night, an inch and 2/3 of rain before it quit. Opportune for the crops, the homespun columnist states with satisfaction about that fog forecast goose drowner. And I sit thinking of all the rain that must have seemed like, after the years of drought, the land suddenly swimming with valuable moisture, and more of it coming as May went off the calendar wetly. Steps on the stairs, it is the volunteer evening librarian telling me apologetically that she has to close up now. I close the red binder on the 1939 newspapers, go out into the summer night, there under the northern Rockies. A couple of years later, when my novel English Creek is published, there, in my fictional version of the summer of 1939, a forceful, ranch-born woman named Beth McCaskill shows up almost immediately. And the book's opening sentence reads, "That month of June swam into the Two Medicine Country." And now, in this run of hearts, we come to the last vital pulse on the page, the one I don't know what to call except the blood sum of the writer. Magical, inexplicable, whatever it is, but the literary quality by which a writer writes better than he has any right to. By which Faulkner, who could barely rouse himself to sort mail in a somnolent Mississippi post office, had somewhere in him the ambition as a writer to put everything into one sentence, not only the present but the whole past on which it depends, which keeps overtaking the present second by second. By which Yeats, his pince-nez eyeglasses perched on his upper crust nose, somehow, could see deeply to where all ladders start in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. To take a lesser example here now, again, my own, for the next 6 or 8 minutes as a kind of finale in trying to tour you through the makings of books, I'm going to do a bit of show and tell. Tell you what I, as a professional writer, am trying to do in this stretch of writing, and then let you hear it. This little scene involves Mariah McCaskill, a highly intense photographer for a Montana newspaper. Mariah is newly back in the American West, having won a Fuji Fellowship, bestowed upon her by me, to travel the world and take pictures for a year. Mariah is also licking her wounds from a failed love affair with a New Zealand glacier guide named Colin. Colin, much younger than her, wore his total philosophy of life on his Mount Cook guide service sweatshirt. "Glaciers are a kick in the ice." As you'll hear, Mariah, now back home in the American West, is trying to shoot a feature photo up along the Rocky Mountain front in northern Montana for her Sunday paper. And what I'm trying to do with Mariah and the scene is to bring the emotional and the physical actuality together. The patron saints of writing have long shown us that this is something worth doing. For instance, the great rhythmic nexus of experience and feeling that Faulkner gave the fugitive Joe Christmas in Light in August. When Joe Christmas flees from the beating he's been given, staggering bloody and drunk into a Mississippi street, the whiskey died away in time and was renewed and died again, but the street ran on. The street ran into Oklahoma and Missouri and as far south as Mexico and then back north to Chicago and Detroit and then back south again and at last to Mississippi. It was 15 years long. To cut Faulkner short, which is always a shame, the point is to try to get the writing to the frontier, there on the page and in the reader's mind, where a character's predicament is both physical and metaphysical. So, here is Mariah, and I'm trying to get her to that point
by using rocks and birds.
Stalking rocks, Mariah traipsed up yet another hillside. This was one of those days in a photographer's life when a desk job didn't sound nearly so ridiculous. The slopes of these lesser benchlands south of town were hummocky, covered with diminutive mounds where tough, wiry grass sprouted, and not much footing in between. She had been on her feet for hours out here, trying for some semi-respectable shot to send in for the Sunday paper. She stopped and blew for breath. With one thing and another, by now the best light of the morning was gone. Her camera bag weighed on her like a mail pouch on catalog day. The wind was starting to blow, and she discovered she had left her close-up lens in the van. Nor were the damn rocks cooperating. She was in search of the right rock face. Out in this lower end of the bench country, the glacier leavings were big lone stones called erratic boulders, the size of Volkswagen Beetles, deposited by the ice sheet when it pushed out of the mountain canyons. Such rough old displaced chunks often were rouged with orange lichens, so that they resembled decorated Gibraltars on the prairie. Shoot the right one from up close against the wavery horizon of grass, and it would make an effect like crossing Ouija with Van Gogh. She felt mildly guilty resorting to this, but you could slap anything inanimate on a Sunday page and readers would think it had more than everyday meaning. She knew a passable picture existed somewhere out here. She just hadn't found it yet. Two rocks later, a distant upright shape caught her eye, off on one of the foothills to the west. More curious than convinced, she half-trotted back down to the van and drove as close as she could get on a fence-line road. Then she trudged up the hogback, skirting little stands of jack pine and switchbacking against the steep incline. She's going to be as ticked off as she was leg-weary if the thing up top wasn't what she hoped. It was, though. Not one rock, but many. A cairn, square-cornered, tapering as it rose, fitted together like a stack of exceedingly thick jigsaw puzzles from the slate-like stones of a broken outcropping nearby. Amateur dry rock masonry, as all these were, but done with divine patience. Already camera to eye, Mariah was focusing in on the head-high sentinel mound. It was a sheepherder's monument. These stood on the ridge lines and the shoulders of mountain pastures throughout the Two Medicine Country, where she and her sister Lexa grew up, each stone stack the product of boredom or mania or whimsy, or the need for a landmark or a grazing allotment boundary, or simply the urge to build something well. Back in the times when the McCaskill bands of sheep were part of the wool tied on these slopes along the Rockies, their sheepherder might build one of these in a fevered afternoon to take his mind off a sudden terrible thirst for the attractions in the Skid Row bars in Great Falls. Another might fiddle around all summer erecting one or two, perhaps a puzzle piece layer a day, the monument corners exquisitely joined, as on this one, with proper fit as the only mortar. On one of the camp-tending trips of their girlhood, their father was inside the sheep wagon in touchy diplomacy with the herder, while she and Lexa proudly tussled up a sizable rock and crammed it onto the cairn the man had underway nearby. The herder came out, saw their achievement, and threw a fit. "What's that doing on there? That's a bad leave." After he quit raving and expelled their rock in favor of a smaller one that chinked more readily into place, the girls grasped that whenever stones were forced to fit together the way theirs was jammed in, it left trouble when the next stone had to be inserted. The leave was what you left yourself to start again. "I'm going to cry," Mariah realized. "I never cry." There had been a cairn like this at Te Aroha, on the South Island of New Zealand. Colin had taken her home to meet his parents. It reached that stage. He and she drove down from Mount Cook farther and farther south into red fertile hills, every so often Mariah dandling a hand over to his in ratification of the scenery, but also as if to make sure of his wordless presence. Sheep raisers evolving into bed and breakfast providers, Colin's folks scrupulously put the two of them in separate bedrooms, but adjoining. Mariah entered into the occasion still having hopes for something lasting, still shoving the difference in their ages as far to the back of her mind as she could. Throughout her Fuji year of traveling, there had been the embassy types hitting on her with invitations to tennis and evening functions, the guides and taxi drivers in 20 countries asking, "Your husband is where?" To which she would look them in the eye and say, "He is in a business meeting with your secret police." Colin, with his mountaineer grooves and his god bod, was a more straightforward proposition than any of those. A home weekend with him, though, except for his visit in the night, proved to be quite a length of time. After it dawned on Colin that Mariah had seen sheep before, and the fields of giant turnips they fed on were interesting for only so long, he took her to the coast, to a nesting refuge of royal albatrosses, to Tearoa. And there the stupendous birds, yachts of their kind, came swooping in from Antarctica, constant thousands of miles of glide on the circular air currents to bring food to their young. Those jumbo youngsters perched on the cliff brinks, like dodos, resolved to pass the evolution exam this time around, lifting their wings over and over again in the testing wind along the New Zealand coast. And in would come another parent albatross with its 10-foot wingspread, sailing with the South Pole at its back. Mariah was enchanted, lit up through and through with this spectacle of wingspans beyond angels. If she was remembering her Brit-lit course right, Coleridge had to resort to serious drugs to reach this point. To be out of the wind while she got her camera into action, she tugged Colin down onto a grassy spot behind the marker cairn of purplish stones on the crest of the headland, built by some fallen to the bottom of the world Scottish sheepherder, she wondered. Then she crawled out a little way into the blowing grass, settled down there in the tussocks, scoping the bear cub-sized chick through her long lens, turning her head upward to catch each whispered flight of the elder royals. She watched by the hour, Colin stoically bored behind her, the wind ruffling no feathers of aspiration on him. I think there, with a woman determined to soar in her work, to glide this blue planet with those royal birds, is as good a last chapter today as any. In my own voyaging over the world of words, I keep coming back to those three main elements I've cited, those three hearts of writing: the dance of the language, the home country we speak from, and the day-by-day push into unexplored white space. It's that last blood-central urge that keeps writers a living species, I believe. The lions of narrative, the foxes of mystery, the griffins of sci-fi, the watchful herons of history, the gazelles and dolphins of poetry, the badgers of biography, the lop-eared leopards of memoir, all of us creatures of Shakespeare's ark must live by the energy of our imaginations. Thank you. gasping loads of air into himself and shedding an equivalent in sweat, Mitch time and again took a look around at the scattered tons of stone and went back at it. He underhanded the football-sized rocks, hefted the larger ones with his hands under each end as if moving an anvil. His aunt's provisions saved him, the water jug wrapped in a wet gunny sack for coolness of drink, and at noon, the lunchbox glory of food, two thick sandwiches and a couple of pieces of fried chicken and a cinnamon roll and an apple. He ate then and every noon in the shade cast by the high rear tires of the tractor, around him the first fresh country of his life. As if in rebuke of the plowed ground, the prairie next to the field bloomed with Indian paintbrush, lupine, and Queen Anne's lace. And there was the sweet grass, thin golden whip bunches of it, lending its vanilla smell as the sun warmed it. With the flywheel monotony of the tractor shut down, the sweetgrass made a whisking rattle as the wind blew through it. Some weeks of that June and July and August, the field threw itself in Mitch's face, fine dirt blowing off the rocks as he lobbed them aboard the stone boat, 6 days out of seven. The Conlins determinedly rested on Sunday, watching preachers on television from Canada with the abstract gaze of obligation. By the second Sabbath, Mitch was running the buffalo trails that zigzagged up the east butte of the Sweetgrass Hills. Building up his wind for football, he labored into view after view. Now the Rockies a distant low wall in the west, now grain elevators pegged into the prairie amid the strip farming. The top of the east butte awaited the reward of color. Everywhere around him, from up there, the farm gold of canola, the green of spring wheat, the blue of flax. And there were days he worked even though the field was muddy, the rocks coming up with a sucking sound, his footing slippery, and his memory on the accident beneath the truck a year ago. But in any weather, this was something to get hold of, to wrestle to a finish, even if the result was merely a mound of rocks at the edge of a plowed land. As that summer deepened, the country around turned tawny, and Mitch along with it. He had his father's attribute of effortlessly tanning. Before long, he could work with his shirt off, young cinnamon giant there amid the surprising pinks and blue grays of the rock spill against the greater brown of the soil. He muscled up, thickened at the chest and thighs, his leg now stronger than new, his arms seriously powerful pulleys. The machine of his body became faster at the rock picking. There was an immense coarse beauty to this season of work. The huge days and the infinite shapes of the rocks, the peninsular solitude of the hills so quietly clocking through him, the earned voyages of the stone boat to the end of the field and back again, that he knew he was honing himself against. What he was on his way to becoming he didn't know, though he daydreamed version after version. Pilot, Mountie, fullback for the Cleveland Browns. None of it his father's route. He was determined on that. But whatever his life turned out to be, the footprints of it started in these independent hills where the sweet grass sang its song. Lexa found him in the machine shop, sweating and weeping. "Son of a bitching death, Lex," he said to her through the tears. "You have to cry your guts out at it. Anybody's."
Which, of course, we knew. She peeks in the second box, lifts out the other half of the outfit with an, "Oh, I have to send you two to town all the time." Puts it on by ducking down to adjust it just so in Dad's shaving mirror. Turns to us, rigged out new from head to toe. "Charlie and Ivan brought me the nicest pair of brown boots and a big hat," her letter reports. "So I am a combination cowgirl sheepherder now."
I seem to have been brought here to think out loud a little, instead of sitting staring at my keyboard and waiting for it to tell me what to think, as I do on ordinary days. To think out loud about stories,
and what they mean to us. Myself, I'm in the business of catching stories, hunting them, corralling them, looking them over, trying to pick out the next likely one, the best of the herd. It's a strange occupation, I suppose. Preoccupation, some people would say. But at least it deals in one of humankind's best urges instead of the wide market of humanity's worst urges. The urge to know all the shapes and sizes and colors life comes in. That, I think, is why stories are told and get listened to. We know that stories become vital to us very early. The novelist Eudora Welty recalls, as a small child in Mississippi, she would plant herself between the grown-ups in the living room and urge them, "Now, talk!" Looking back on that, she thinks her hunger to hear those grown-ups talk was her origin as a writer. Children, like animals, use all their senses to discover the world, Eudora Welty says. Then artists come along and discover it the same way all over again. The best description of stories as handled by writers that I've been able to find is the one by the poet Randall Jarrell, whose poem The Woman at the Washington Zoo is in itself one of the most magnificently done American stories. Randall Jarrell said, "A story is a chain of events. Since the stories that we know are told by humans, the events of the story happen to human or anthropomorphic beings, gods, beasts, and devils, and are related in such a way that the story seems to begin at one place and end at a very different place without any essential interruption to its progress. The poet or storyteller, so to speak, writes numbers on a blackboard, draws a line under them, and adds them into their true but unsuspected sum." To me, those true but unsuspected sums occur not only on the blackboards of literature and poetry and drama, of speech and folklore. They are writ large in other great areas of learning as well. One of the best workers of story we had in America in this century was an anthropologist, the late Loren Isley. The opening story in Isley's book, The Immense Journey, tells of a day on the long grass prairie of the middle of America when he went down into a crack in the earth, a narrow limestone slit, which he realized when he had inserted himself into it was a perfect cross-section through perhaps 10 million years of time. An anthropologist being an anthropologist, Isley writes next, "I hope to find at least a bone." What he found instead was a skull embedded in the limestone. It was not human, some creature pre-human, with, Isley says, a low, pinched brain case in the face of a creature who had spent his days following his nose and whose power of choice was very small. Though he was not a man nor a direct human ancestor, there was yet about him some trace of that low, snuffling world out of which our forebears had so recently emerged. Under the prairie sky, Loren Isley stares down at that skull. The skull stares, sightless, up at him. And Isley writes of that moment, "This creature had never lived to see a man. And I, what was it I was never going to see?" It seems to me that in that single sentence, Loren Isley managed to write the immense story of humankind. I've spent some time, quite a lot of my adult life, trying to figure out what it is within stories and the telling of them that is as valid and vital for an anthropologist as it is for a poet or a novelist. The best I can come up with, and more I think it may be enough, is craft, the craftsmanship, intrinsic to good storytelling. I had an unexpected lesson in this when I was working on my first novel, The Sea Runners. In trying to write about New Archangel in a time when Alaska still was Russian America, I wanted to know what kind of wood in the ship timbers and lumber piles my characters would be seeing and smelling as they walked along the New Archangel waterfront in the 1850s. I got in touch with a park ranger up at Sitka, as New Archangel has become, an expert on the carpentry and shipbuilding during the period of Russian America. The ranger gave me not only the working details I needed, yellow cedar was the distinctive smell that I put into the book, but he also wrote out for me a quote from the English poet William Blake. "Art cannot exist but in minutely organized particulars." When I finished blinking over the literary and philosophical bent of park rangers at the time, I saw that this ranger in Sitka told me something I already believed but hadn't known how to say, that when craftsmanship is done well enough, it begins to be art. A quick example. At one turn of the plot in my novel Ride With Me, Mariah, Montana, the three main characters visit the family ranch that one of them, Riley Wright, turned his back on for a newspaper life instead. Riley's rancher brother, Morgan Wright, shows up briefly to confront Riley, and here is Morgan's appearance. Morgan stood spraddled, thumbs alone showing from the weather-worn hands parked in his front pockets, as though it might take all the time in the universe to hear this matter out. The vital word, what is sometimes called the crystallizing detail in that sentence, is the verb parked. Those hands parked in the front pockets of Morgan's blue jeans, habitually, naturally, not stuck in his pockets, jammed in his pockets, but just, by God, parked. And I suppose I only worked about half a day to come up with that one precise word, that minute particular. In my own case as a writer, not only am I a believer in Eudora Welty's demand to her grown-ups, "Now talk," but my characters usually believe it too. English Creek, the middle novel of my Montana trilogy, I think was a try at catching a story by having a narrator who is himself a story catcher. The novel is about a Montana family trying to pull itself from the effects of the Depression in the 1930s. Trying not to pull itself to pieces in the process. And the narrator is a 14-year-old boy named Jick McCaskill. Jick likes to hear about the family's past. And his mother, in that way that parents and grown-ups have, generally thinks she has better things to do than cater to his curiosity. Here is a brief scene where the boy's quest for story is launched. The small-town weekly newspaper has come this day, and Jick notices that in the 25 years ago column, there is a reprinted item about a wagon trip his mother and her brother and their mother, Jick's grandmother, had taken to St. Mary Lake in Glacier National Park, where Jick's grandfather was providing the workhorses for road building at the time. Jick's mother then would have been about his age now, 14 or so, and he's curious about that journey. A woman and two children, by wagon, alone, across the Montana prairie in the early years of this century. After supper, Jick starts in on his mother. "Where'd you sleep?" She was going through the newspaper. "Sleep when?" "That time, when you all went up to St. Mary." She glanced over at me, then said, "Under the wagon." "Really? You?" Which drew me more of her attention than I was bargaining for. How many nights?" "Jick, what's got your curiosity bump up?" "I'm just interested, is all. Interested in, old times." "All right. That wagon trip to St. Mary. What is it you want to know about it?" "Well, just... why was it you went?" My ma took the notion. My father had been away up there for some weeks. He often was, contracting horses like that. How long did that trip take then? Now, in a car, it was a matter of a couple or 3 hours. She had to think about that. After a minute. 2.5 days. 2 nights, she underscored for my benefit, under the wagon. One at the Two Medicine River and one at Cutbank Creek. How come Cutbank Creek? Why not in Browning? My ma held the opinion that the prairie was a more civilized place than Browning. Were you the only ones on the road? Pretty much, yes. The mail stage still was running then. Somewhere along the way, I guess we met it. This mother of mine could nail questions shut faster than I could think them up. That was just the way she was. A person who put no particular importance on having made a prairie trek and seen a stagecoach in the process. What about the road building camp? I resorted to next. What do you remember about that? The St. Mary area is one of the most beautiful ones, with the mountains of Glacier Park shearing up beyond the lake. The world looks to be all stone and ice and water there. Even my mother might have noticed some of that glory. Here she found a small smile. Just that when we pulled in, Pete, her brother, Jick's uncle, Pete began helloing all the horses. She saw that didn't register with me. Calling out hello to the workhorses in the various teams, she explained. He hadn't seen them for a while, after all. Hello, Woodrow. Hello, Sneezer. Methuselah. Runt. Copenhagen. Ma let him go on with it until he came to a big gray mare called Second Wife. She never thought the name of that one was as funny as Father did. My guess is that my story-catching young character Jick believes, as I do, that stories can be our way of sharing light, of sitting together around humanity's fire with the universal dark all around us, which may be how stories began in the first place. And then somebody went back in the cave and drew on the wall the hunting escapade they had all just been talking about, and the written versions began. Often we simply tell stories to share, to say we are in this together. My wife Carol's mother used to tell that when she was a young grade school teacher all those decades ago, she and the other teachers developed a code to use whenever their principal began one of his surprise print inspection sweeps through their classrooms. The first teacher on whom the principal descended would immediately send a student around to all the other classrooms to knock on the door, poke a head in, and ask each teacher, "Do you have the big scissors?" We do that a lot in telling each other stories, alert one another that the big scissors of life is on the loose. Various famous book-length stories try to bring us these large facts of life, home truths. Open the novel Anna Karenina, and the first sentence you read is, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." Tolstoy goes on for another 950 pages, but you've had the big truth there in the opening line. Other books, considerably more light-footed, give us their stories simply by being such good company. In contrast to Tolstoy's opening pronouncement, listen to the opening of The Summer Book, Tove Jansson's magnificent children's book that is so much more than a children's book. It was an early, very warm morning in July, and it had rained during the night. The bare granite steamed, the moss and crevices were drenched with moisture, and all the colors everywhere had deepened. Below the veranda, the vegetation in the morning shade was like a rainforest of lush, evil leaves and flowers, which she had to be careful not to break as she searched. She held one hand in front of her mouth and was constantly afraid of losing her balance. "What are you doing?" asked little Sophia. "Nothing," her grandmother answered. "That is to say," she added angrily, I'm looking for my false teeth. Then there are writers, story catchers, to whom the language itself is part of the story. To me, these are the real magicians of our tribe, the ones who are not only providing us a narrative string of events, but meanwhile are showing us, see what the language can do? See what the human tongue is capable of? Isn't this a terrific language? We are all interested in the play of language. We all do it. Notice how rapidly the coming of the computer is providing its own vocabulary of slang. It was ever thus. For the background of my novel, Dancing at the Rascal Fair, I read up on the craft of wheelwrights 100 years ago in Scotland. The wheelwright shops where craftsmen made the wagon and carriage wheels the world ran on before train and automobile. Like the computer hackers, the wheelwrights had a rich lingo of their own, as I found when I came onto sentences such as, if you was to nip yourself while getting around over her legs, you'd catch a woodlouse, which translates, if you pinch a finger while hoisting a wagon box onto its wheels, you will get yourself a blood blister. Writers try to use that play of language to see how far it can go. Anais Nin once urged her fellow writers to the use of language as magic, the use of rhythm and image. The fear of using the full span of language would be like denying ourselves the use of an orchestra for a symphony, she wrote. James Joyce tried to tell us in so many ways that man's life does not take place on one level only, but on several simultaneously. We cannot express this with one string. Admittedly, another sort of writer, another sort of storyteller, gives us scenes rather than the spell of language. In American literary history, I suppose Henry James was the high-collared Victorian godfather of this scene sort of storytelling. His biographer, Leon Edel, admits that the prose of James is baroque, difficult, but he thinks it is exactly the social fussiness of every scene in Henry James that is his distinct achievement. He was the most visual of all our novelists, Edel writes. Any page in any of his novels is filled with subtle observation by his characters of their environments. We could say that his eyes were camera lenses, that he turned himself into a mobile camera long before film was invented. Well, maybe. Another way of looking at Henry James's preoccupation with social nuance and baroque exploration of it is that his prose chews more than it can bite off. I think a mark of our great American writers, the ones for whom the language itself is a kind of story, is that they tend to bite off more than they can chew. Melville, Faulkner. Faulkner once told an interviewer, "My ambition is to put everything into one sentence, not only the present, but the whole past on which it depends and which keeps overtaking the present, second by second." Faulkner went on to explain that in writing his prodigious sentences, he is trying to convey a sense of simultaneity, not only giving what happened in the shifting moment, but suggesting everything that went before and created the quality of that moment. A big ambition, biting off a lot. And so you get from Faulkner a sentence such as this one in his glorious story, Spotted Horses, where a herd of mustangs have been brought in from Texas for sale. They are in the corral at Frenchman's Bend, and Mississippi farmers who have spent all their lives slogging behind slow mules are looking longingly at these quick, vivid horses from the West, horses described by Faulkner this way. Calico-coated, small-bodied, with delicate legs and pink faces in which their mismatched eyes rolled wild and subdued, the horses huddled, gaudy, motionless and alert, wild as deer, deadly as rattlesnakes, quiet as doves. An extravagant sentence, which kicks over some rule of writing about every third word, yet one in which the language itself is telling us, those horses were all these things at once. God Almighty, you should have seen those horses. There is always the problem, once you get into a story, how to get out of it, particularly in public. So I'm going to resort to Isaac Dinesen's story about her book, Out of Africa. On her coffee farm in Kenya, in the teens and 20s of this century, as Isaac Dinesen worked into the nights on the manuscript which became Out of Africa, her Kikuyu houseboy Kamanti would stand along the wall, watching. One evening, Kamanti announced to her that he did not think her writing could ever amount to anything. Dinesen records, "I laid down my paper and asked him, why not? I now found that he had prepared himself for this. Kamanti stood with a copy of the Odyssey itself behind his back, and here he laid the blue-bound book on the table. Look, Masabu, he said, this is a good book. It hangs together from the one end to the other. Even if you hold it up and shake it strongly, it does not come to pieces. The man who has written it is very clever. But what you write, Kamanti went on, both with scorn and with a sort of friendly compassion, what you write is some here and some there. When the people forget to close the door, it blows about, even down onto the floor, and you get angry. It will not be a good book." Isaac Dinesen continues, "I explained to him that in Europe, people would be able to fix it all up together. Will your book then be as heavy as this?" Kamanti asked, weighing the Odyssey. When he saw that I hesitated, he handed the blue-bound book to me in order that I might judge for myself. "No," I said, "it will not, but there are other books in the library that are lighter." "Then will your book be as hard as this one?" Kamanti asked. I said it was expensive to make a book so hard. Dinesen concludes, "A few days later, I heard Kamanti explain to the other houseboys that, in Europe, the book which I was writing could be made to stick together, and that with terrible expense it could even be made as hard as the Odyssey, which he again displayed. He himself, however, did not believe that it could be made blue." So that's one method of diagnosing a book, and with more common sense behind it than other reviewers and critics sometimes can muster. And maybe there's some inspiration there for those of us who are professional story catchers, storytellers. We at least must try, as Kamanti wanted of Isaac Dinesen, to make our pages hang together from one end to the other. With a little luck, maybe some of them will turn out to be good enough that we can bind them in blue.